Welcome to Learning English on the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. On the show today, Ashley Thompson and I take you to a warm national park in the Caribbean Sea. And after that, we listen to another classic American story. But first, Jill Robbins and Brian Lynn have a report on current politics in Europe.
Austrian voters could elect the European Union's first far-right leader in a presidential election on Sunday. Norbert Hofer of the far-right Freedom Party is running against Alexander von der Bellen. Von der Bellen is an independent candidate who led the Greens Party earlier. Recent public opinion studies have shown the two candidates with about equal support. Austria held a presidential election in May. Von der Bellen won that election narrowly. But those results were overturned by Austria's constitutional court because of problems with voting procedures. Hofer has taken a strong anti-immigration position during his campaign. Earlier in the campaign, he said he might call a referendum on whether Austria should leave the European Union. Hofer also opposes Turkey's efforts to join the EU and has spoken out against EU attempts to get too much control over individual states.
Von der Bellen criticized Hofer for his positions during a recent presidential debate. He said Austria's possible withdrawal from the EU could result in a flood of right-wing populism. Von der Bellen has called for continued close relations with Germany, Austria's neighbor to the north and biggest trading partner. Hofer has said he wants to strengthen relations with other Central and Eastern European nations, including Russia. He denounced German Chancellor Angela Merkel during a debate. Hofer said Merkel had caused serious damage to Europe by supporting open policies for migrants. He said her actions had allowed hundreds of thousands of migrants to pass through Austria, including terrorists. Experts say the presidential campaign in Austria has been heavily influenced by the election of Donald Trump in the United States. President-elect Trump has called for severe immigration enforcement and criticized Merkel's policies on migrants. Political experts say Britain's vote in June to leave the EU, often called Brexit, also drew attention to the immigration issue.
An opinion study by the U.S.-based Gallup organization asked 800 Austrians how Trump's victory might affect the voting. About 53% said Trump's win will be better for Hofer, while 9% said it will help von der Bellen. The office of president in Austria is largely ceremonial, but the president does hold the power to shape policies, appoint and dismiss government ministers, and call parliamentary elections. Some political observers say the outcome in Austria could mark the beginning of a wave of populist candidates across Europe. In France, the leader of the far-right National Front, Marine Le Pen, says she believes the Trump and Brexit votes gave her campaign momentum. Le Pen is seen as a possible competitor in France's presidential election next year. On Sunday, right-leaning presidential candidate François Fillon won a primary election for France's Republican Party. Fillon, a former prime minister, could face Le Pen in a runoff vote in the country's two-round election system. France's socialist president, François Hollande, has announced he will not run for re-election.
The leaders of right-wing movements in Germany, Italy, and the Netherlands are also hoping to gain from Trump's election. Opinion studies show support for the Freedom Party of Dutch far-right politician Geert Wilders. A general election will take place in March. Wilders has repeatedly made statements against Islam. He was also tried for violating a hate speech law and is waiting for the court's decision. A court charged him with inciting hatred after leading a chant at a meeting calling for the Netherlands to accept fewer Moroccan immigrants. Wilders recently described a worldwide movement that, he says, agrees with his political message and the ideas of other far-right leaders. He says the movement is driven by voters. He says they are tired of politically correct ideas from traditional politicians and media companies. Brexit proved it. The American election proved it, he said. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
This week on our national parks journey, we leave the United States mainland and travel down to the Caribbean. There you will find three islands that make up the United States Virgin Islands: St. Croix, St. Thomas, and St. John. The Virgin Islands National Park is a tropical paradise on the island of St. John. The park covers more than half of the small island. It is surrounded by the Atlantic Ocean to the north and the Caribbean Sea to the south. The climate here is warm all year. Tall green peaks rise from the ocean, which is filled with wildlife. The island's white sand beaches and clear blue seas are considered to be among the most beautiful in the Caribbean.
Evidence of human history on the island dates back thousands of years. Archaeological evidence shows the first people to arrive on the Caribbean islands came in canoes from South America more than 2,750 years ago. The Taino people lived along the shores of St. John Island. Over the years, the population of the Taino natives grew. You can see evidence of the Taino culture in the petroglyphs within the Virgin Islands National Park. Christopher Columbus first saw the island in 1493. Later, Spain, Holland, England, and Denmark all tried to claim the Virgin Islands as their territory.
In 1762, after many struggles, Denmark took control of the Virgin Islands. In 1917, the United States bought the islands of St. John, St. Croix, and St. Thomas from Denmark. By the 1930s, news of these beautiful American islands spread to the mainland United States. It marked the beginning of what is now a profitable tourist industry. And in 1956, land on St. John Island formed America's 29th national park.
Lawrence Rockefeller was an American millionaire, businessman, conservationist, and philanthropist. He visited St. John in the 1950s. He quickly fell in love with the island's clean, pure beauty. He purchased a small resort there, Keneal Bay. He also purchased more than 2,000 hectares of the island and donated it to the government. That donation created the U.S. Virgin Islands National Park. It was officially opened as a national park on December 1, 1956. Along with land, the Virgin Islands National Park today protects almost 3,000 hectares of coral reefs, marine life, and shoreland. In 1978, much of the nearby Hassel Island was also donated to the Virgin Islands National Park. The only way to reach the park is by boat. Some people arrive on their own sailboats. Others come in on large cruise ships. Visitors also arrive on water taxis from the island of St. Thomas. St. John offers many kinds of places to stay: very large or very small hotels, villas, or campgrounds with wood-framed tents.
From the tropical hills to the blue waters, there are many things to do at the Virgin Islands National Park. Visitors enjoy fishing, camping, sailing, scuba diving, snorkeling, and bird watching. There are many hiking paths to take. Some of the walking paths lead visitors to historical ruins. These ruins help explain the park's cultural history. The Peace Hill Trail, for example, is a short walk up a rocky and sharp hill. It leads to the Peace Hill Windmill Ruin. People built the windmill centuries ago. The windmills made energy for sugar production. The Cinnamon Bay Trail goes through a forest and leads to the ruins of the Cinnamon Bay Sugar Plantation. Along the way, hikers smell the scents of mango, kapok, and apple trees. Some of the oldest and tallest trees in the park are found along the Reef Bay Trail. Hikers also pass Danish sugar plantation ruins stone walls, and ancient rock carvings, or petroglyphs, from the Taino people. Along the way, there is also a huge waterfall, freshwater pools, and animals, such as deer, bats, and land crabs. Some of the hiking trails end at a beach where you can swim, snorkel, or dive.
Of all the park's beaches, Trunk Bay Beach is said to be the most striking. Below the clear blue water is a 200-meter snorkeling path. Signs beneath the water describe the turtle, coral, and exotic fish species found here. Hawk's Nest Beach is also a popular place for snorkeling. Near the shore are three small reefs of elkhorn coral. The elkhorn coral gets its name from its shape. The reef looks similar to the huge horns of an animal called an elk. It is a very rare kind of reef. Scientists say it is in danger of becoming extinct. The Virgin Islands National Park is often called America's Paradise. It protects St. John's pristine nature and preserves the record of human history in the Caribbean. Now it's time for an American story. Shep O'Neill reads Luck by Mark Twain.
I was at a dinner in London, given in honor of one of the most celebrated English military men of his time. I do not want to tell you his real name and titles. I will just call him Lieutenant General Lord Arthur Scoresby. I cannot describe my excitement when I saw this great and famous man. There he sat, the man himself, in person, all covered with medals. I could not take my eyes off him. He seemed to show the true mark of greatness. His fame had no effect on him. The hundreds of eyes watching him, the worship of so many people, did not seem to make any difference to him. Next to me sat a clergyman, who was an old friend of mine. He was not always a clergyman. During the first half of his life, he was a teacher in the military school at Woolwich. There was a strange look in his eye as he leaned toward me and whispered, "Privately, he is a complete fool." He meant, of course, the hero of our dinner. This came as a shock to me. I looked hard at my friend. I could not have been more surprised if he had said the same thing about Napoleon, or Socrates, or Solomon. But I was sure of two things about the clergyman. He always spoke the truth, and his judgment of men was good. Therefore, I wanted to find out more about our hero as soon as I could. Some days later, I got a chance to talk with the clergyman, and he told me more. These are his exact words. "About 40 years ago, I was an instructor in the military academy at Woolwich when young Scoresby was given his first examination. I felt extremely sorry for him. Everybody answered the questions, well, intelligently, while he, why, dear me, he did not know anything, so to speak. He was a nice, pleasant young man. It was painful to see him stand there and give answers that were miracles of stupidity. I knew, of course, that when examined again, he would fail and be thrown out. So, I said to myself, it would be a simple, harmless act to help him as much as I could. I took him aside and found he knew a little about Julius Caesar's history, but he did not know anything else. So I went to work and tested him and worked him like a slave. I made him work over and over again on a few questions about Caesar, which I knew he would be asked. If you will believe me, he came through very well on the day of the examination. He got high praise, too, while others, who knew 1,000 times more than he, were sharply criticized. By some strange, lucky accident, he was asked no questions but those I made him study. Such an accident does not happen more than once in 100 years. Well, all through his studies, I stood by him with the feeling a mother has for a disabled child. And he always saved himself by some miracle. I thought that what in the end would destroy him would be the mathematics examination. I decided to make his end as painless as possible. So I pushed facts into his stupid head for hours. Finally, I let him go to the examination to experience what I was sure would be his dismissal from school. Well, sir, try to imagine the result. I was shocked out of my mind. He took first prize, and he got the highest praise. I felt guilty day and night. What I was doing was not right, but I only wanted to make his dismissal a little less painful for him. I never dreamed it would lead to such strange, laughable results. I thought that, sooner or later, one thing was sure to happen. The first real test, once he was through school, would ruin him. Then the Crimean War broke out. I felt that sad for him that there had to be a war. Peace would have given this donkey a chance to escape from ever being found out as being so stupid. Nervously, I waited for the worst to happen. It did. He was appointed an officer, a captain of all things. Who could have dreamed that they would place such a responsibility on such weak shoulders as his? I said to myself that I was responsible to the country for this. I must go with him and protect the nation against him as far as I could. So I joined up with him, and away we went to the field. And there, oh dear, it was terrible. Mistakes, fearful mistakes. Why, he never did anything that was right. Nothing but mistakes. But you see, nobody knew the secret of how stupid he really was. Everybody misunderstood his actions. They saw his stupid mistakes as works of great intelligence. They did, honestly. His smallest mistakes made a man in his right mind cry and shout and scream, too, to himself, of course. And what kept me in a continual fear
was the fact that every mistake he made increased his glory and fame. I kept saying to myself that when at last they find out about him, it will be like the sun falling out of the sky. He continued to climb up, over the dead bodies of his superiors. Then, in the hottest moment of one battle, down went our colonel. My heart jumped into my mouth, for Scoresby was the next in line to take his place. "Now we are in for it," I said. The battle grew hotter. The English and their allies were steadily retreating all over the field. Our regiment occupied a position that was extremely important. One mistake now would bring total disaster. And what did Scoresby do this time? He just mistook his left hand for his right hand, that was all. An order came for him to fall back and support our right. Instead, he moved forward and went over the hill to the left. We were over the hill before this insane movement could be discovered and stopped. And what did we find? A large and unsuspected Russian army waiting. And what happened? Were we all killed? That is exactly what would have happened in 99 cases out of 100. But no, those surprised Russians thought that no one regiment by itself would come around there at such a time. It must be the whole British army, they thought. They turned tail. Away they went over the hill and down into the field in wild disorder, and we after them. In no time there was the greatest turnaround you ever saw. The Allies turned defeat into a sweeping and shining victory. The Allied commander looked on, his head spinning with wonder, surprise, and joy. He sent right off for Scoresby and put his arms around him and hugged him on the field in front of all the armies. Scoresby became famous that day as a great military leader, honored throughout the world. That honor will never disappear while history books last. He is just as nice and pleasant as ever. But he still does not know enough to come in out of the rain. He is the stupidest man in the universe. Until now, nobody knew it but Scoresby and myself. He has been followed day by day, year by year, by a strange luck. He has been a shining soldier in all our wars for years. He has filled his whole military life with mistakes. Every one of them brought him another honorary title. Look at his chest, flooded with British and foreign medals. Well, sir, every one of them is the record of some great stupidity or other. They are proof that the best thing that can happen to a man is to be born lucky. I say again, as I did at the dinner, Scoresby's a complete fool.
That was Shep O'Neill narrating Luck by American writer Mark Twain. I'm Katie Weaver for VOA Learning English. Thanks for joining us.
It's music time.